Well, that's the theme music from the game Doom. And we're introducing us here to another episode of Conservative Casual Friday, a weekly Blog Talk radio show with your show host, Andrew Herod, where we like to discuss important issues of the day for conservatives and others. And we're in sort of an apocalyptic frame of mind today as we want to discuss the issue of whether there are American biological weapons laboratories in Ukraine. What is the truth behind these accusations? Is this just propaganda? And we want to discuss these important issues with Center for Security Policy Senior Analyst for Strategy, Michael Waller, who's an expert on propaganda and modern Russian history. Well, thanks for joining the show, Michael.
Oh, it's great to be on with you, Andrew.
Well, first, just starting out, what do you think? Are there biological weapons laboratories in Ukraine? Where did this story come from?
Well, they were old Soviet biological weapons laboratories in Ukraine that the U.S. helped the Ukrainians take control of so that this stuff wouldn't proliferate out, and then to convert the use of those plants into, you know, legitimate civilian health related uses. Problem is, we're not getting really straight answers from our federal officials about what's really going on.
Mm-hmm. How so? Why do you think there's any sort of what sort of confusion or mystery is there?
Well, it began when Deputy Secretary of State Victoria Nuland was asked in a Senate hearing, does Ukraine have any biological weapons? And rather than say yes or no, I believe the answer is no, rather than say yes or no, she started dissembling and talking about how we have all of these laboratories that we're funding and working with in Ukraine to safeguard old remnants of Soviet weapon systems, and then to have other, you know, medical and other scientific research purposes under secure conditions. So she could have just said yes or no about Ukraine not having biological weapons, but she didn't say that, and that's the trouble.
Mm-hmm. So you think there are probably no biological weapons there? Could there be biological weapons there, or I mean, would we participate in keeping such weapons there in Ukraine, or a program ongoing?
Well, yeah, Ukraine inherited anything that was left on its Soviet territory became Ukrainian property, so we can't just go in and take the stuff there. But what might be left, what appears to be left, are pathogens from the Soviet period or programs from the Soviet period that are not level 4, meaning they're not Wuhan Institute of Virology level security, but they're necessary for fighting certain types of disease or learning how to combat certain types of disease, and then keep scientists employed so they won't go off and work for the Iranians or the Russians or the Chinese or some others. You know, that was the rationale of the U.S.-funded program. So Ukraine doesn't have a biological warfare program of its own. I think the only people saying that are the Russians and some of their apologists. But the fact that the Deputy Secretary of State, who's really been immersed in Ukraine for 25, 30 years, wouldn't give a yes or no answer, that's the troubling part that has actually helped Putin fuel his propaganda.
Mm-hmm. And why do you think that Victoria Nuland did not give such a yes or no answer? What is the problem there?
I there's a lot of questions about her that I can't explain. Here's somebody who worked for Hillary Clinton and Dick Cheney, and now she's working for Biden as the number two in the State Department. So she's a person who, one of these Washington, D.C. policy fixtures where Ukraine has been one of her pet projects now for a generation. And why she won't give a straight answer, I don't know. I she might have been trying to just prepare people to accept the idea that the U.S. was funding these labs, but it wasn't a secret. It was funded openly through congressional appropriations and through contract bidding. So I don't know what the issue was. The other weird thing was the State Department pulled down its information about those labs from its website.
Mm-hmm.
Something's
why would the State
right.
Department do that?
I don't know. Maybe they, you know, it's not like you can't go to the Wayback Machine and find it. They restored some of those pages back onto the site, but for several days they were down. It was a big story. It's like, why did the State Department take these pages down the same week the Deputy Secretary of State wouldn't say yes or no about Ukraine having a bioweapons program? This just fed into Putin's propaganda. It could be as much as bureaucrats covering their behinds in a very awkward questions at an awkward time. It could have been some sort of narrative shaping where it's not so much the truth that matters anymore, it's the narrative that matters. Or it could have just been covering up for wrongdoing. You just don't know.
Mm-hmm. Well, in this program we're talking about here,
I would never give short shrift. Sorry.
Oh, go ahead.
No, I would never give short shrift to the idea that, I mean, it's easy to think there's a conspiracy, and oftentimes there is, but we must never discount incompetence. And there's so much incompetence in Washington anyway that a lot of what we see as really nefarious, sinister strategic planning is actually ineptitude.
Mm-hmm. Well, in this program we're talking about is this cooperative threat reduction, or the Nunn-Lugar law initiated by Senators Nunn and Lugar way back in the early 1990s, right after the dissolution of the Soviet Union, to deal with these, as you say, all of these weapons programs in the former Soviet Union, and to try to make sure that, transform them into civilian projects and make sure that, you know, the scientists and others did not say go work for Iran or North Korea and spread their technology and threats. Has this program been effective?
Well, if you keep moving the goalposts, you can say it's been very effective. Yeah, I followed it in Russia, not so much Ukraine at all, but in Russia, where the idea was to prevent proliferation of weapons of mass destruction by paying to dismantle and dispose of the obsolete material, and then to pay the scientists and engineers to help them retool into a civilian economy and not go work for other bad actors elsewhere. That part of it was, depending on how you measure it, it was either a partial success or a complete failure. The reason I would say it's a complete failure is because it subsidized what the Russians were going to be dismantling anyway on their own, because they were building more modern weapons of mass destruction systems. And so in building their new systems, in order to be compliant with their arms control obligations, they had to dismantle their obsolete stocks and programs anyway. So we were literally paying them to remove the obsolete stuff while they modernized into fifth generation weapons of mass destruction. And so we effectively subsidized their modernization.
Interesting. There's been controversy, particularly in Ukraine. Why is this program still ongoing? I mean, in Ukraine, apparently it came up that we had been working with these biolabs in Ukraine since 2005. Is it just simply we have to, keep funding these labs in order, you know, for at least like, I don't know, a generation or something, to keep scientists from not going to Iran or something?
Well, this is one of the things that doesn't make sense. You figure these were Soviet labs 32 years ago, 33 years ago. Your junior scientist 33 years ago is now in the process of getting ready to retire now. So that means almost everyone has attrited out since the Soviet collapse. So as a jobs program to keep people from making weapons of mass destruction for the Ayatollahs in Iran, it makes no sense. It was a terribly run program if that's the way it was done. Again, we don't know how it was done that way. If it's something different, though, I mean, these different countries are going to have their own biological research programs, so that when we say biolabs, it sounds really sinister. But, you know, every high school almost has a biolab. You know, most colleges have some kind of a biolab. It just means that it's the laboratory for biological studies. So it doesn't mean bioweapons lab. And that's where I think a lot of people have gotten very upset, is they think that these are all bioweapons labs and bioweapons programs that we're funding in Ukraine. A lot of it is not that at all. It's simply old Soviet plants that are actually doing decent work, we think, in combating certain types of diseases, whether it's plant-based diseases or agricultural or human diseases or whatever. That might make some sense, especially if the Ukrainians might have a proprietary ownership of certain discoveries that would be beneficial to the United States. Or it might be that other bad actors might get what Ukraine's doing and use it in ways against us, not necessarily as weapons. The thing is, we just don't know because there's not that much clarity.
Mm-hmm. Well, in looking at Ukraine specifically, do you have any knowledge of what sort of role did Ukraine play in the Soviet arms industry?
Ukraine has produced some of the world's best aviation and rocket and missile engineers. So our own Igor Sikorsky came from Ukraine. And the largest heavy lift aircraft in the world come from Ukraine, the big Antonov aircraft. And the Soviet SS-18 intercontinental ballistic missiles that have now been dismantled, they were designed and built in Ukraine. So Ukraine has a huge wealth of knowledge and engineering infrastructure for aerospace programs. It's really valuable.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah. So I guess seeing in this fighting here, you know, this has been a skilled defense from Ukraine. So it does sort of show, Ukraine has significant military knowledge and weapons knowledge to put up such a fight.
Right, and they have a very strong nuclear industry, both in terms of producing civilian nuclear power plants, but scientists and engineers who used to design and build Soviet nuclear warheads. And this has been a problem where you do have Ukrainian nuclear engineers who have been hired by the Iranians for their weapons program. So in this sense, you know, there was a problem with proliferation, and no amount of U.S. money could have stopped that.
Mm-hmm. Well, thinking about Russians promoting a story that their biological weapons labs in Ukraine, is this something that traditionally the Russian government does in its propaganda efforts?
Yeah. I mean, it's really necessary for any war propaganda. You have to demonize your opponent, and you have to give a righteous reason for your own fight. So if on the one hand the Putin government is saying that Ukraine is being run by Nazis and we have to go rescue Ukraine, and oh, by the way, there are American bioweapons labs there and we have to make sure that those don't become used against us Russians or unleashed against the rest of the world. So it's pretty good propaganda to those who'd be ready to receive the message.
Mm-hmm. And have the Russians done this kind of thing before?
Sure. Sure, they did it with, when the HIV AIDS first came to light in the 1980s, they alleged that this was a biological warfare program run by the U.S. Army out of Fort Detrick, Maryland, and that it was designed to attack ethnic minorities and wipe out people of African extraction or people in Africa. So, and they did it even during the Korean War as well. The United States was going to launch a bio warfare program against Asian people.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And is there much evidence in Russia itself? Does the Russian public believe these stories?
From what I gather from talking to people who are there, they get very adamant that unusually adamant that they think, by and large, that either Putin is doing the right thing in Ukraine or that it's understandable that he's doing something that's regrettable, but it's still excusable and understandable because they're getting almost no straight information anymore, and there's a huge amount of social pressure now put on to support the Russian troops when they're in a state of war.
Hmm. Interesting.
There's one of the mistakes about Western social media companies and others cutting off access to Russia and cutting off services to Russia had the negative effect of cutting off the free exchange of information into Russia. And so that's a really unfortunate byproduct of these blanket sanctions, is that we're allowing Putin to keep his narrative inside Russia.
Mm-hmm. Well, how might the West, the United States, and other countries, how might they try to penetrate through to Russia to get alternative information in there?
Well, we've got our old-fashioned systems like Radio Liberty, Radio Free Europe, both on both digital and shortwave. Those are and people in Russia still listen to shortwave, especially in the more remote parts of the country. But then you can get it through any kind of social media. Now, Putin closed down some Western social media. Twitter still allows Russian social media, and that can be beneficial to us because it's good to know what the Russian regime is saying, but it's also a way to get information into Russia. But when you shut down, when, say, Apple or other companies would shut down their services into Russia, they're also shutting down Apple News, which I don't have much confidence in their, you know, editing of what we see on Apple News in the United States, but at least in Russia, it would be very important to getting in real reporting of the war and what's happening inside Ukraine and these testimonies of Russian pilots and Russian soldiers who volunteer to be on Ukrainian TV to say what they thought they were sent there to do and that they realized this was that they were even misled into running their attack. Or didn't even know why they were in Ukraine in the first place, or sometimes didn't even know that they were in Ukraine. So these kinds of messages are very important to getting back into Ukraine. And another thing the Ukrainians are doing skillfully is they're allowing the prisoners to call their parents back home. And so this is now, you know, not just a humanitarian thing. The Ukrainians are doing it for war propaganda purposes. But it's at least getting credible firsthand stories in across Russia about what's really happening.
You know, people have it's been mentioned that perhaps such a allegations by the Russians, you know, you talk about justification for the war, that this might be preparing the Russians to have an excuse to use chemical or biological weapons in Ukraine. Do you think that might be true? Could that happen? Has that happened in the past?
Yeah, really anything's possible. The Soviets did use chemical weapons in Afghanistan. Putin has used chemical and biological and radiological weapons on a micro scale to conduct his assassinations abroad, including in the United Kingdom, as well as inside Russia. So we know there's no philosophical opposition to using these weapons. It's just a matter of scale. And really, if you look at it from the most cynical point of view, possible. If Putin really thought he could take Ukraine in 3 days, which seems to be what he was thinking, and now he's realizing he has to destroy the country's whole infrastructure, then he might be thinking, how can we kill the people but leave the infrastructure intact?
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Right. Yeah.
That's where your chem bio weapons would be, or pure radiation weapons, would kill off the population and save all the infrastructure.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. What would be the possibilities for the West to react in such a case? I mean, what kind of a response, what sort of deterrence could we have?
We don't really have much deterrence value for Ukraine because it's not a NATO ally, so there's no direct military response on Russia proper. We had no real strategy to deal with this impending invasion, even though Putin gave a speech last June, and he's actually been talking about it in one degree or another since 2007. So the fact that this is some surprise that would allow us not to have a strategy is just ridiculous because you had the big Zapad 2021 exercises in southern Russia and Belarus right on Ukraine's border last September where they had 200,000 troops massed there. The Biden administration didn't even say a word about those, didn't express any concern at all. That was a planned operation, though. In the ensuing months, though, the Biden administration was very diligent about making public as much intelligence as possible about Russian capabilities and intentions to invade Ukraine, getting very granular down to a very local level about the sizes and the nature and the types of military force being stationed in various parts around Ukraine. So we know the Biden administration was aware of all this going along, but they never developed a strategy. The only proactive move the Biden administration took was to lead in pulling the U.S. and Western embassies out of Kyiv before the invasion and to try to convince Zelensky to abandon his capital city and move further west. There was no other thing that the U.S. took the lead on. It was generally others who took the lead.
Interesting. Yeah, so then there's really nothing to sort of stop the Russians from using chemical or biological weapons in Ukraine.
No, unless public opinion matters, but obviously to Putin, it doesn't matter at all.
Mm-hmm. I mean, could maybe...
Having said that, though... Having said that, he might be able to use it as a legitimizer, saying, I was forced to use these weapons because they used it first. Or, no, we're responding because the Western countries or the Ukrainians themselves used these weapons against us, so it wasn't our germ warfare that was being used in Ukraine. It was the Ukrainian germ warfare that that we were responding to.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess one idea I thought of, I was sort of playing around thinking, maybe the West could respond with, like, say, cyber attacks on Russia if Russia resorts to, say, chemical or biological weapons use in Ukraine.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of that going on already, and the U.S. certainly can calibrate what, in a disciplined way, the types of cyber attacks it wages against the Russian forces. But the Ukrainians also have their cyber army of volunteers, and they've done a good job on the Russians in the past. They did in 2014 when they actually took control. They hacked into Russia's tank and armor command and control and gave false orders. And then they took down the grid in Crimea through a cyber attack, and they hacked into Putin's executive secretary's emails and then doxed them, published them. So they have really good capabilities of their own. I mean, if you need a good hacker, find a good Ukrainian computer guy, because they're world class in the hacking world.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah, once again, a skilled, educated population, so it has a lot of capabilities. Do you find it disturbing that this story of biolabs in Ukraine is getting such sort of, people pointing to, like, the far right in the United States, or even now, a big thing that Tucker Carlson is really talking about on his show is, does that show that the Russians really having success with their propaganda claims?
Yeah, this is kind of a disturbing thing, because I've always been watching, ever since Soviet times, the Soviet active measures, Russian active measures, always had their effect on the left. So I've been watching the left, now since the 80s, right, being mouthpieces for the Kremlin on campaign after campaign against U.S. defenses and against U.S. national security interests and so forth. So, but we'd be naive or dishonest to think that the Russians wouldn't be trying to get anybody they could to repeat their line for them. And the trick is to get unwitting people to do it, because it's part of their own belief system. And then you get into, well, is somebody providing their own opinion with their own information that just happens to coincide with something beneficial to Putin, or is it something more nefarious? In looking at some of these guys, and some of them are my friends, so, and I've had some difficult conversations with them, they've become so alienated from our traditional national security community, which has gone woke, which has been weaponized in many ways against some of our favored political candidates and leaders and causes, and has really become abusive and politicized institutionally. How can we trust our own national security community anymore when they get this way? Whether it's the FBI and Comey and Peter Strzok and others, or whether it's the CIA and Brennan and the whole Steele dossier, and all this became straight through elements of our national security community, or got the thumbs up from them. How can we trust them anymore? Or our wokeness within the U.S. military. How can we trust it anymore? Or the fact that it's the Soros people and the Biden people and the Hillary Clinton people who are all so immersed in Ukraine. Why should we care about that country anymore? And Putin is the one who's standing up to the World Economic Forum and the globalists and, whatever semblance of Western or traditional values he actually or pretends to be promoting. It's understandable to see how the people in the West who are alienated from everything the left is doing can want to give the benefit of the doubt to somebody who seems to be an adversary to all of those forces. But we can't look at the world in that binary fashion. We have to look at the fact that we have multiple factions of people and organizations and governments around the world and even here at home who don't mean us well.
Mm-hmm. You're right. I've talked before with a former Defense Intelligence Agency analyst on a previous show, Rebecca Hoffman, and she's, you know, she said that, you know, Vladimir Putin, coming from the KGB and so forth, he's really good at sort of this kind of psychological warfare stuff and, finding out what other people want and sort of playing on the views, like, playing this whole idea of being Christian, when George W. Bush met with him and Bush announced, like he looked into Putin's soul and so forth. So, apparently he's very good at really playing on whatever feelings other people have.
Right, and he has a good team to do that to work with him, where he had a whole makeover himself. So I met him once in 1994, and I just thought he was a sleazy, greasy, you could tell he had just exuded KGB coming out of his pores, and I refused to shake hands with him. I didn't know who he was. He was just a deputy mayor of St. Petersburg at the time. So years later, when he became Yeltsin's security minister in Russia, I recognized his face, and then I said, is that the same? I asked some Russian friends, is that the same guy I met? And they said, yeah, that was him. So he was not a charmer by any means back then. He wasn't this alpha male type persona at that time. He was very introverted because he was running a criminal operation with the legalized mafia of St. Petersburg. So when he had his remake after he became leader of Russia to be this traditional values, alpha male standing up for Russian nationalism and all things that are good in the Christian world. Of course, Vladimir Putin was none of those things, but he came across that way, and he enchanted a lot of people that way, even if they didn't dare, even if they knew he was a bad guy at heart. He might be a bad guy trying to do the right thing. This is not my argument. This is what others have said, and I can understand how they might admire that type of persona, but it's completely misplaced.
Interesting. So you say you met him in St. Petersburg in 1994, and you refused to shake his hand. Why was that, or how, you just simply because he was from the KGB, or what led you even in that early encounter to say this is a bad guy?
Well, I didn't even know he was KGB then. I was working with Russian activists who had been part of toppling the Soviet Union from inside. And then by this time in the early 90s, I had written my doctoral dissertation on the KGB during the Soviet post-Soviet transition. And in meeting so many KGB people, I sort of developed, kind of a gaydar for KGB types. And you can kind of sense who somebody is just by something about them. And it was just I didn't know he was KGB. I just thought this is a really sleazy, dirty character. He had terrible eye contact. He had something about him that I just found. I'll say hello to him, but I'm not going to shake his hand, and I'll just move on and go grab another dish of something over at the table. It was at a big reception with the St. Petersburg City Council, So he didn't strike me as anybody then. Somehow along the way, I don't think it was so much him as getting KGB training at this, because he was never a foreign intelligence officer. He was an internal security officer. So this whole story about him being a spy master is completely false. He never made it to foreign intelligence school because of some problems with his own background that made him subject to blackmail by a Western intelligence service. So he became an internal security officer who was briefly stationed in East Germany to oversee a local Stasi office. But it's that kind of person where there was not much that was memorable about him, except for the fact that he was a senior city official who just looked like a real sleazebag. He didn't have that that cooler vibe to him until much later.
Mm-hmm. And what was blackmailable about him such that he could not get into the spy network?
He had been he had been part of a street gang in Leningrad when he was a teenager that preyed on weak and effeminate boys. And they would rape these boys. And we got this from three separate guys. We interviewed the people who knew him as a teenager then. So he had studied English and German and law with the goal of being a foreign intelligence officer. And he was admitted to the KGB. And then in the course of his background investigation, they said, whoops, you've got this part of your past where the West, can blackmail you for this. But you'd be a great internal security officer. So we have similar protocols here. People, we go through, as you know, full field background investigation. Is there anything in your past that for which you can be blackmailed, among many other things? And if you're gay or something, I mean, fine. You just have to tell your family has to know, and your closest friends have to know, so that you're not in the closet and you can't let a hostile intelligence service blackmail you with that secret. So if you want to get the clearance, then you have to make sure that it's not a secret, so you can't be blackmailed for it. But in Russia, which doesn't tolerate that kind of stuff in its society, especially back then, that was a dirty, dirty secret, and he had to keep that secret. So he made a fine internal security officer.
Well, that's interesting. So, this is precisely the guy that, some people are looking to as a, Christian conservative that is actually engaged in some sort of pederasty or such in Leningrad.
Yeah. And it was part of a gang thing. Now, what the nature of his, personal orientation is, who knows? It could be a power thing. It could be some kind of a, I'm not going to speculate on it. The point is, though, he does have that in his past, and he does show real hostility toward the gay movement in Russia, and he sees that as a threat to Russianness and to the greatness of Russia. And this is all a George Soros, World Economic Forum, rainbow flag plot to destroy Russia. And so he's going to be the big defender of it. And a lot of people think, hey, okay, that makes sense, from a Russian nationalist perspective or from a traditional, even a traditional Christian perspective, that, oh, we've got finally someone who's going to stand up to this big agenda. Let's close our eyes to the other bad things he's doing, and let's at least tolerate him or try to be understanding of what he's doing. Now, I don't want to cover it because I've seen – I know you're not going to do it, but people will cherry pick the text of a podcast like this and say that I'm trying to make excuses or praise the guy. Not at all. I'm trying to just explain how Russian people view him and why he would have any kind of popularity to be seen as a strong leader who's defending the rights of the Russian people and the great Russian society.
Well, as you've indicated, what do you think the extent is of Putin's popularity today among conservatives in America and around the world?
I don't think he really has real popularity. I think that it's just that there's so much negativity and hostility toward the Bidens and the Hillary Clintons and the Soroses and the Davos group that anybody who's up against those guys who are trying to transform our own society against our will and take away our own Judeo-Christian values and our own America firstness and all this, that there's got to be more to the story than what we're being told. This is what a lot of people suspect. And so I think you're going to see people, and we have been seeing people, making arguments that seem like Putin propaganda. And to me, some of them sound like Putin propaganda, and I wouldn't be at all shocked if they were getting a line from there. But others, I know that they're just so alienated from what liberal leftism, progressivism has done to America that they simply won't accept what to me is obvious about things in Ukraine now, which is Russian imperialism that does threaten us and threaten our interests, is attacking a sovereign country, and it's not going to end in Ukraine because Putin has been very plain about it not ending in Ukraine.
Mm-hmm. Right. So there would indeed
there is indeed a grave potential for wider threats to like the Baltics and other countries.
Sure, because it's not a restoration of the Soviet Union that Putin is looking at. It's a restoration of what he calls historic Russia, Great Russia, and that extends into Poland as well as the Baltic states and other countries as well. And if once he's laying claims on Poland and Baltic republics, these are our NATO allies that we're bound by treaty to defend militarily at all costs, which means we will all have nuclear targets painted on our heads.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, indeed. Well, you know, talking about conservatives and Putin, what about say leftists and Putin? Has Putin been able to play them as well? I mean, I think, for example, you know, Russia Today, RT, you know, they always had a lot of, you know, like anti-American leftists on that, like Chris Hedges and, you know, this Abby Martin and so forth. They always got promoted. How is the left now responding to Putin and the war in Ukraine?
Sure, and this is part of the left is divided on this, but this is a great point because Putin has also engaged the American left and the left in Europe and elsewhere as well, and you haven't heard a peep out of the Hillary and the Soros people on any of that, which shows the, you know, this is not a binary political or policy issue. This is something Putin's playing everybody he can. He's had Angela Davis on RT on this Russia Today show, and you know she was a Soviet-controlled asset back when she was a senior U.S. Communist Party official and vice presidential candidate, and she went on Russian state TV to announce in June of 2020 that she was going to support Joe Biden. Meaning she was telling all the extreme left, don't run your protest presidential candidates this year with your different communist and socialist parties. Everybody, let's get behind Biden because he's going to need every vote he can possibly get. And she literally said on Russian TV that we can get a lot more out of Biden than we can by just running our own protest candidates. So you have that. You have remember that the Biden was fine with Putin until a certain point. When Putin first took power, Biden welcomed that as a sign of stability for Russia and for U.S.-Russian relations. Obama's Secretary of State, or Clinton's Secretary of State, rather, Madeleine Albright, Bill Clinton's Secretary of State, welcomes Putin in, and within his first month in power, she was meeting with him, saying that he's a sharp, patriotic leader who's going to be a good person to work with. She was effectively praising Putin back in 2000. And you had even the Soros people were fine with Putin until such time as they were no longer fine with Putin.
Interesting.
And the environmentalist movements, too. The anti-fracking movement was funded by Russian government interests, both in the United States and in Europe. And the anti-nuclear movement in Europe was funded by Gazprom, the Russian gas company, with the idea to shut down Europe's nuclear power plants and in the name of saving the environment, but then replacing it with what? Replacing the energy with gas piped in from Russia.
Right, indeed. Yeah. He really plays the whole spectrum here. I mean, environmental movement, going after alienated conservatives and so forth. Yeah, it's a very multifaceted, multi-front assault, very skilled. How about China? Are they emulating Russia propaganda efforts? I mean, there's been, I guess, some reports from China that they've also sort of pushed this whole biolab story.
Yeah, they've pushed the story because this is consistent with the Chinese efforts over the past 2 years to divert attention away from the Wuhan Institute of Virology and the source of the COVID-19 pandemic. The Chinese Communist Party media was saying this to their cadre a little over 2 years ago, to say, let's push any blame away from China and the Communist Party, and then ultimately let's blame the United States. They were blaming the Italians for a while, too. They were calling it the Italian virus.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
So this is the Chinese have a much better way of influencing American opinion and American debate and the American media and American politicians than the Russians ever did.
Really, how would you compare Chinese influence operations with Russian influence operations?
Well, first, I would the Chinese are far superior. Far superior because they have penetrated our institutions, our political, business, academia, media, in ways that the Soviets tried to, and they did very well during the Cold War with their active measures operations that would last decades. So if you wanted to do business in the Soviet Union, you had to toe the Communist Party line or fund those who would do so for you. The Chinese are still that way. So, but the Chinese have co-opted a far more broad swath of American society than the Soviets ever could. The Soviets went after the liberal left for the most part. The Chinese have gone after everybody, and they've done so magnificently, to the point of buying into American media companies and social media companies and big data companies, and then having those companies. Look at the Walt Disney Corporation, for example, one of the biggest media companies on earth, through ownership of a major news network and then through its entertainment. Now it does whatever the Chinese Communist Party line wants it to do, even down to its movies, down to children's movies. I don't know if you ever saw the South Park episode of one of the characters ends up going to China to sell marijuana, and he's thrown in prison, and who does he meet in there but a bunch of Disney characters and this tyrannical Mickey Mouse who's working for the Chinese communists tormenting them. So it was a really great riff on what the Disney company is doing in league with the Chinese Communist Party. But this is something that the Soviets never could have done, and the Russians are really amateurs in comparison.
Well, how should America counter such influence operations from China and Russia? What steps do you think should need to be taken?
First, it's simply public awareness, and people didn't want to believe it at first. Now they do. I think the overreach on censorship with COVID and not allowing alternate means of alternate, you know, scientific theories or scientific solutions or medical solutions and expertise to even be discussed really show the American public that, hey, somebody's out here to censor us and to keep us from knowing the truth or even discussing real solutions. If we're going to be, even as individuals, canceled from Twitter and Facebook, and, you know, imagine what the big media has been doing, and that's fairly well proved itself. And so general individual awareness is the first thing. The second thing is I've made it a habit simply not to watch TV. So I don't watch any TV at all anymore, and I found it to be a much better use of time. And then you don't get all these messages pounded into your head, even if you know better. So I just aggregate my news now from different news organizations, and I'm not subject to this Chinese water torture of certain lines of information or disinformation.
Interesting. Yeah. I personally also don't watch much TV. I mean, I don't have any cable television. I, you know, maybe just watch like videos online, or, you know, for personal entertainment, just rent DVDs or such from the library. But you find that television in particular is really just becoming just propaganda. And I mean, any and all television. I mean, like not even Fox News, you know, is often held forth as, you know, like an alternative, but you think even there that there's sort of influence operations.
Well, anyone on earth is going to use any means they can to influence us. So how do we insulate us from it? Most of what you see on TV is junk anyway, even if you like it. And you know, when I don't eat my favorite, you know, candy, it's good for me when I don't eat it, right? But it doesn't mean I don't like it. So, but if I just stay away from it, it's going to be better for me. And most TV news is just junk. So whether or not I happen to agree with it. So, you know, why don't you stay away? And then set up your own news aggregation system online or wherever else you get your information and be wise to it. And then stay away from those entities that have bad track records for repeating the Chinese line, or at least being, or the Russian line for that matter, or at least they can be tolerant of other views. So if they're trying to censor certain views, just stay away from them. It's like with the New York Times coming out this week saying that, gee, the Hunter Biden laptop story was true. Remember how viciously the New York Post was attacked for releasing news of the Hunter Biden laptop thing, saying it's all Russian disinformation, it's all Russian plot. It was none of those things at the time. People knew it at the time, but the journalists, even the journalists who knew, would not say it at the time because it didn't fit a narrative. We've gone from factual reporting as liberal or as biased as it was in the past. It was still generally fact-based, but now it's narrative-based.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. Well, thinking of this biolabs issue in Ukraine, how has COVID-19 influenced this story?
Well, it makes everyone more conscious about the bio threat against all of us. I think it's not such a remote threat anymore now that we've already been faced with this pandemic. And it's been, now we're learning, it was a much more mild pandemic than we were all led to believe as they're revising the numbers downward of people who've actually died from COVID-19. So it's made it more real for us that there are bioweapons out there, that there are dangerous biolabs out there, that the U.S., like the American taxpayer, funded the Wuhan Institute of Virology. It's funding these other labs around the world. This is a scary thing if we don't know what it is. And then when you, again, have the number two person in the State Department, when asked a yes or no question by a senator, does Ukraine have biological weapons, and you don't hear yes or no, you instead hear a whole explanation of how we're funding a series of bio labs in Ukraine, then that's going to get people scared.
Well, and I guess thinking of maybe you follow the story more than I have. Thinking of COVID-19, has the evidence really solidified, or has anything really been pinned down as what the origins of COVID-19 was? I mean, was it indeed from this Wuhan Institute for Virology? I guess, was indeed a weapons lab for the Chinese.
Yeah, well, remember, we were not allowed to even discuss this for a year and a half, maybe almost 2 years. Couldn't even discuss this. Why was that? Who imposed that rule on us that we couldn't even take seriously? This was a right-wing conspiracy theory that the virus originated from the Wuhan lab of virology, and there was an acceptance of the Chinese regime party line that it might have come from a wet market a few miles away. And then we learned, wait a minute, the Chinese army has a three-star general who's in charge of bioweapons. So that means we know that the Chinese military has a huge bioweapons program if you have a three-star general running it. And she's put in charge of everything to do with that lab. And we still can't decide as a country. We still can't find out as a country where that virus originated, to the point where last summer the U.S. intelligence community, so all 17 agencies of the intelligence community, came out with a report by the Office of the Director of National Intelligence on the origins of the virus. And the intelligence community could not come to a conclusion about the precise origins, they said, because the Chinese authorities won't help us.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of intelligence community do we have if we need the Chinese Secret Service to confirm whether or not their lab was the source of the virus?
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, and I guess you know, the whole issue of COVID-19 coming out of a bio lab in China, that once again, as you say, only reinforces concerns about any such bio labs in Ukraine. So that really heightens the concern.
Right. And there's been so many lies and so much false information and so much, you know, phony narrative and social pressure on people not to talk about certain issues, and then real pressure and cancel culture, you know, censorship of people talking about it, that on the COVID pandemic, that, of course, people are going to be highly sensitized now to anything concerning biolabs anywhere, to the point where you hear the word biolab and people freak out, even though, you know, we have many, many thousands of biolabs across America. But we don't worry about them because we don't confuse them with bioweapons labs.
Right. Well, thinking of such influence operations by the Chinese and the Russians and others, how does modern media, you know, social media today in the 21st century, how does it alter such propaganda campaigns from what you've seen in the past, say, during the Cold War?
Well, before you had a very few different channels of you know, media outlets. You had the mainstream media was the media. And you had some small print and radio, conservative media, or other alternate media. But it was all fairly establishment, and the average person didn't have a voice. Now with social media, of course, anybody can set up, like your podcast, you can set up your own media operation and speak and write freely. But then it came down to the COVID crisis and the whole issue of the Chinese government being behind it and the whole issue of coercive measures being taken that were not necessarily based on science to modify American citizens' perception and behavior. And now we're being told by these private media companies, social media companies, that we're not free to talk about those things because it's a threat to public safety and it's misinformation. And so rather than let the truth come out by people having just debate and discussion, you have these big data companies and big social media companies censoring debate, really on behalf of the Chinese Communist Party.
Mm-hmm.
So we were shown how the freedoms that we have with social media can be taken away from us in an instant. And then when you develop an alternative, like Parler, it gets taken down immediately by those larger data companies, although the smaller ones depend for their technology base.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I guess that's something really new. I guess in the past I can't think of really any such comparable private sector censorship. But now precisely now that media sort of moved into these new technologies, that's opened up the possibility that you can really have a lot of censorship that didn't and a lot of control that didn't exist in the past.
Yeah, and they can shut you down in a second, and they can not only shut down your ability, but they can take away your living. Think of the people who've made their livings doing podcasts or doing, you know, YouTube channels, and they were making, you know, they quit their regular jobs because they were doing so well, and then literally in an instant, their entire way of making a living is shut down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and then
yeah.
Their payment systems are shut down if you're a vendor. And your credit cards aren't being processed, or your PayPal and Venmo won't be processed, or all these other ways to just shut you down completely, even certain banks not allowing certain people to have banking services because the bank doesn't like their point of view. And it's all couched in this phony safety theme. Oh, it's all about keeping us safe. No, it's not. It's about political control. So they're massing it all in safety. And then the big internet companies are shielded from any liability because they have a special, you know, the Section 230 status. They're treated like public utilities where the phone company can't cut your phone service off just because it doesn't like your views, or the water company can't cut off your water supply because it doesn't like your views. So it's free from liability because it's a public utility for everyone. And that's what these big media and big data companies are hiding behind, because they get Congress to treat them as public utilities. But really, they are media outlets with their own editorial controls, which means they are liable for their content.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, in this era, you talk about how you don't watch TV. What should Americans do to really what can we do to really try to avoid any such falsehoods or influence operations and to really find out the truth about what's going on in the world? What sort of techniques would you recommend?
Well, I would diversify sources of information. So I wouldn't just depend on news organizations that I like or that I agree with. But where you have quality journalism and accepts it for its bias, coming from some other organization, but it's still interesting news. It gives you a point of view that you can check your own sources against, because you like to hear it doesn't mean it's true, or just because you like that person's persona on TV or that podcast doesn't mean it's true. So just get as much different information that you can on your own without being anybody's tool, and think for yourself. And the moment anybody tries to shut you up by saying that you are unsafe or you're a public danger or you have to trust and follow the science or what you're spreading is misinformation or disinformation, immediately suspect anybody who accuses you of those kinds of things, because they're accusing your motives, and that's because they want to shut you down.
And I guess similarly,
some of the people accusing you of disinformation are the ones who are spreading misinformation themselves. And if they confuse the two, which so many of them do, misinformation and disinformation, there's a big difference between the two. But those who are saying, we're going to shut you down because you're spreading misinformation. Well, what is misinformation? It's a mistake. You're making a mistake on facts or a mistake on interpretation of facts. There's nothing malicious in that. It's just a mistake. Everybody makes a mistake. But disinformation is deliberate. So that's easy. Misinformation is mistake, and disinformation is deliberate. And that's where the danger is. But when you have people accusing you of being a channel for disinformation, they're questioning your motives. And if somebody questions the motives of the average person, then that type of individual can't be trusted.
I guess, I mean, you know, one issue in particular, you coming from the Center for Security Policy, and I also, write for Jihad Watch, and Robert Spencer's also been affiliated with the Center for Security Policy. You know, this whole idea of Islamophobia, you know, that's being spread. I guess that raises issues of you know, how do you get an alternative viewpoint to that sort of propaganda line that's put out that on issues involving, say, Islam, that there you have deplatforming and censoring and so forth. I mean, that would be one example.
Sure.
Of what do you do there?
Yeah, well, we've all been through that. So, you know, we are the Southern Poverty Law Center calls us a hate group. And so you look at us on Wikipedia and, oh, we're an anti-Islamic hate group. There's no way of getting out of that. Wikipedia has locked down any changes to preserving your reputation on it. So they're taking one or two people's very rare statements over a many-year period, and they brand the whole group as a malicious hate group. And the person might have just misspoken, or it might have been taken out of context, or maybe it was something that they really said, but it was in a much different situation. So, like with Jihad Watch, you're not against Muslim people there; you're against jihadists, right? But if the jihadists and their brethren in the Muslim Brotherhood and other, we call them soft jihad or precursor jihad or whatever type of organizations, are the ones to shut you down as a hater because you hate their long-term agenda, which is what? To overthrow the United States government, the United States Constitution, and subvert our society and put it under some sort of Sharia law. And they want to do this to people around the world. And you're accused of being a hater because of that. So there's this mindlessness and maliciousness to these types of attacks to invalidate your point of view, as the Chinese would do, as the Russians would do, as the Soros type people would do, as the Muslim Brotherhood would do. And they're all using the same architecture to intimidate and silence people, and then to discredit those who are still courageous and persistent enough to keep speaking out.
Well, okay. For our listeners out there, you've been hearing another episode of Conservative Casual Friday, a weekly blog talk radio show where we like to discuss important issues of the day for conservatives and others with your show host, Andrew Herod. And today we've been discussing the issue of accusations of biological weapons labs in Ukraine with Center for Security Policy Senior Analyst for Strategy, Michael Waller. Well, Michael, thank you for joining the show.
Andrew, it was great to be with you. I really enjoyed it, and I hope it fulfills the apocalyptic doom beginning of this hour.
Yes, well, and for our listeners out there, tune in next week, next Friday, for another episode of Conservative Casual Friday.